The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to Mom and Dad Are Fighting, Slate's parenting podcast for Thursday, May 16th, the Violating the Uber Pool Code edition. I'm Gabriel Roth. I'm the editorial director of Slate Podcasts, and I'm the father of Leo, who is 4 3/4, and Eliza, who is 8.
I'm Rebecca Lavoie, a journalist and podcaster in New Hampshire, and I am mom to Henry, who is 17, Teddy, who is 16, and my stepdaughter, Lily, who is 18.
And I'm Carvel Wallace, a writer and podcaster in Oakland, California, and I'm the father to Georgia, who is 13, and Ezra, who is 16.
Today on our show, we have a question about what to tell the kids when you're getting divorced, but you're still going to live in the same house. Plus, as always, we'll have triumphs and fails. We'll make recommendations. On Slate Plus, I'm going to answer a question somebody raised on our Facebook group about why I talk the way I do. But let's start with triumphs and fails. Rebecca, do you want to go first? Do you have a triumph? Do you have a fail? What do you have?
I've got a triumph, and it's related to something that happened this weekend. I was in Brooklyn doing a podcast show, and my mom came. She came down from Vermont and stayed with a friend of the family who lives in Manhattan, and she came to the show, and it was like the perfect situation in which for me to interact with my mom. You know, as you know, we have a complicated relationship that sometimes our communication crosses wires. It's putting it very diplomatically, but in the light of what happened, I want to sort of keep it in that frame. And it was basically like an ideal situation for me to interact with my mom. She was coming to a thing, so there was an activity. And then all of the hanging out afterwards, there were like a lot of really interesting people for her to talk to. So it was like I got to spend time with my mom with basically like 30 buffers around. You know, it was like it was basically perfect. But the thing that was such a triumph was really my mom's triumph. I learned something amazing about her that I can't stop talking about because it just kind of like blows my mind. She's kind of a Luddite. If you were to do a walkthrough of my mom's house, you would wonder if it were perhaps 1870 or 2019. You might not be able to tell. And she was a late adopter to all kinds of technology. And she's the kind of person, like, she has her iPhone like in one of those giant OtterBox cases. And it's like from like 6 iPhones ago. And it's always frozen because she refuses to delete any of her voicemails or photos because she wants to like remember what her grandkids sounded like 6 years ago. So it's her phone situation is like always a disaster. But one of the things that she has learned to do in the last couple years is she started, since my stepdad died, she's been doing a little more traveling. She always travels by car. That's her jam. Like she's never flown. She hasn't flown for like 30 years. She like drives everywhere. But when she goes somewhere so that she can go out and like do stuff with people, she's started using Uber, which, you know, is a really nice like convenient tech development for my mom to have, because when you're out with her in a place like New York, you know, she's going to be able to get where she's going and not have to worry about like, you know, her waiting for a cab and stuff. So anyway, I was standing on the outside this bar we went to after the show on Saturday night, and we had about 10 minutes until her Uber came, and she had asked me to like help her with the app, like the pickup location. She was having trouble seeing. Really, when I took her phone, what it was is that like her phone is so needs to be updated and it's so frozen that like nothing works. I was like stabbing through the plastic, you know, case that she has on it, and it came time to sort of like hit the confirm ride button, and she was like, no, don't do that one. She goes, that's Uber X. I want Uber Pool. And I was like, you want Uber Pool? I was like, well, it's like, Mom, it's a long ride. You know, we have to wait 10 minutes for it anyway. It's already like, you know, like $35 ride or whatever, because it's like from Brooklyn to Manhattan on a Saturday night. And the Uber Pool, it's like $2 more. Are you sure you want the Uber Pool? She was like, oh, I love Uber Pool. That's how I get to meet people. I love meeting people at Uber Pool.
Wow. Wow.
And she was like, yeah, she was like, on the way out here, was in a car with this really interesting immigration attorney. Last time when I was in D.C., I got to ride in the car with these really interesting people who work for the Department of State. Like, she is super into Uber Pool. She's like super duper into it. It's become like a social space for her and a chance to talk to people and like interact with new people. And I just think, like, on the one hand, well, I think it's, like, hilarious and, like, adorable in the way that, like, you know, when older people adopt technology and they use it differently than you would, it's hilarious and adorable. But it's also, like, kind of awesome that she's taking this random opportunity to interact with strangers and like really seem to be like embracing it. I mean, I don't know how the other people in the pool feel about it, but she seems super cool with it. And I thought that was really fun. So that is my triumph of the week. I'm dedicating it to my mom. Congratulations on your deep embrace and love for pooling your ride sharing just so that you can meet strangers and talk to them.
That is amazing. That's, I mean, it's like one person's victory is another person's nightmare. I, the reason I don't take Uber,
so
pool, or any, I'm just like, don't fucking talk to me. And
same.
Even drivers, like, I'm just like, what are you doing? Well, you're headed to the airport. Yep, that's what I said. Traveling for work? You know what? We've already said enough, sir. Enough information has been exchanged.
I feel the exact same way, except that I do use Uber Pool, especially when it's considerably cheaper, because I'm confident in the code of Uber Pool, which is that you don't talk to the other person at all.
Don't fucking acknowledge this. Yeah.
And the fact that your mom is like taking pride, and you by extension are taking pride in your mom's total violation of the code of Uber Pool. I don't know about this.
Listen, my mom loves to violate the codes all the time. This is one that doesn't affect me in any way. So I just think it's really funny. And also, you know, she was also saying that the friend of the family that she was staying with, this woman like we've known our whole lives, was basically saying to her like, you know, wow, you take those driving apps. Isn't that dangerous getting into a car with someone you know? And apparently my mom is like, what are you talking about? Everything's dangerous. How is that more dangerous than taking a cab or riding the train or whatever? I'm like, wow, mom, really like coming around. So I guess I just like it that she's become like the intrepid older lady who's like, you know, talking to strangers and, you know, I don't know. Something about it that's very charming
that.
To me.
Yeah, I like
although I would say if I were to get into an Uber with my mom and she was not my mom, it might be fine. But if I were to get into an Uber and take it and it was pool and then my actual mom, who is my mom, were to get in the car at some other stop, I would probably change my destination very quickly. Sorry, mom.
Listeners,
I mean that with love.
Listeners, if you would like to violate the codes with Rebecca's mom, try Uber pool. All right, I have a fail this week, and it's a fail that it took me, I did a bunch of work to get to this fail. Like, this is a fail that results from, like, concentrated, careful parenting. We've been having this thing with the kids where, like, A, we try to get them to behave better, and B, they want stuff, and so we've tried to combine those things into one delicious combination of incentives, right? Where, like, we had a sort of chore chart and a sticker chart where if they, you know, get ready, it's all about getting out the door in the morning. If they, like, brush their teeth and have their backpacks ready and do all the stuff they're supposed to do, this is mostly Leo, who, you know, is almost five, but a year ago it was just hard to get him through all the different stages of getting ready in the morning. And so we started making a chart, and if he completes all the tasks, then he can put a check, and if he gets all the checks, then he gets a sticker, and if he gets enough stickers for the week, then he gets to have a little thing or something on the weekend or whatever. And obviously, like, it worked a little bit, but the problem that you're going to run into is you wind up constantly negotiating about what's an acceptable reward for doing the basic stuff that he needs to do. Like, can he have this big, huge toy that's going to cost like hundreds of dollars just because he like brushed his teeth every morning for a week? No, he can't have that. That doesn't make sense. But he's always going to be pushing the boundaries of what we are willing to offer him. So over the past few months, we've been transitioning to an allowance system where like they have to do this stuff and we assume they're going to do the stuff. And if they do, then they get their allowance. And so then they can spend the allowance on whatever they want. We hadn't been doing an allowance before. So now we're doing an allowance. And I think it's basically good, especially because Eliza is eight and like should now have a small amount of spending money and get to make her own decisions about it. But we can't just give her an allowance and not him and still be doing this complicated routine with him. So they both get an allowance. And they were excited about this, and I started like giving them the allowance and make sure they like have a place that where they put it, so it's not just change floating around the apartment, but like where does your allowance go? And then on the weekend, Tally, my wife, was out of town, and so I was with the two of them, and I'm looking for activities. And one of the activities is a thing they like to do. We're going to go to Barnes & Noble. They love to go to Barnes & Noble, and they can spend their allowance or whatever they have saved up. So this is good because we're going to Barnes & Noble. It's not going to be like we're going there, but you don't get to have any of the things, or you only get to have a little thing. It's like you can have whatever things you can buy with your money, and then you have less money, and that's the way the resource allocation is going to work now, is according to like capitalist principles for distribution of scarce resources. So we're in Barnes & Noble. And Eliza finds a book, and it, like, you know, looks like a fine book for her to have. And she's decided this is the book that she wants, and she has enough money for it. And so, great. The system is working as it should. And now Leo gets to pick something to spend his allowance on. And, you know, he has like $7 total. And the first thing, if he goes to the Lego section, because Barnes & Noble is mostly a toy store. He goes to the Lego section, and the first thing he points to is like a giant Lego spaceship from the Lego Movie 2. And he's like, can I get that with my allowance? It costs $80. So I said, no, you know, you can't get that. You have $7 and this costs $80. And he says, oh, okay, well, so can I get this smaller thing? No, that costs $25. So now he's just looking around the Legos. He thought he was going to get a thing with his allowance, and he's not getting a thing. And so he finds the one thing on the Lego shelves that he can get with his allowance, and it's a Lego Movie 2 mystery figure, which is to say it's like a little packet that has one of the little Lego guys, and it's one of the characters from the Lego Movie 2, but you don't know which one. And you have to pay $4 to find out. There's a whole bunch of
things. Question mark, dum dum.
Yeah. And I know where this is going. Like, this is not my first rodeo, right? I know that, like, if you when you see Lego Movie 2 mystery figure, you should mentally change the label to bag of disappointment. Like, that's what you're going to do. You're going to spend $4 on a bag of disappointment. And I tried to, like, explain that to him. Like, you think it's going to be something great, but it might not be the thing you want, and then you will have spent your allowance because you have to already spend the money in order to open the bag and see what thing it is. And if it's not the thing you want, then it's going to just be really a bummer. Are you sure you want to spend your allowance on this? Yes, I am sure. I was like, okay, if you're sure, because you don't know who it's going to be. And he's like, yeah, no, I know. I don't mind. I still want to get this. So then we're walking around Barnes & Noble, and he's holding onto his Lego minifigure, and I hear him say, as if to himself, I bet it's Batman. And I was like, no, 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 dude, I promise you it's not Batman. And he's like, how do you know it's not Batman? And I was like, it could be Batman, but there's so many of these other guys. I look at the packet and Batman is on there because he appears in the Lego Movie too. But there's so many other characters. It's probably one of these many, many other characters and not Batman. And he's like, oh, well, I bet it's Emmett then. Emmett is the lead character of the Lego movies. And I'm like, okay, but let's assume it's not Batman and it's not Emmett. What if it's Lucy, the girl character? Are you going to be okay if it's Lucy? He's like, yeah, Lucy's great. Okay, well, so that seems pretty good. Okay, what if it's not Lucy and it's not Emmett and it's not Batman? And I look at the packet and I'm like, what if it's Abraham Lincoln? Because there's a little Lego Abraham Lincoln. He's like, yeah, that's okay. I like Abraham Lincoln. So I'm like, okay, you're sure you're fine with anybody at all? And he's like, yeah, I'm fine. So then we go down and we pay for the stuff and he gets his thing and we're like, on the street outside Barnes & Noble, and he's like, can I have my mystery? I'm like, okay, and I give it to him. And he rips it open, and it's like a Lego figure of like a little girl who looks like a big Crayola crayon, like she has a big crayon. And there's a little label that says, Crayon Girl. And he's like, huh? And I said, oh, look, it's Crayon Girl. And he was like, what the fuck is this shit? This is bullshit. Oh, man. And like, I knew that was gonna happen. Like, the moment we saw the Lego mystery figures, I knew that was where this was going. And I like look her up on my phone. She appears in the Lego Movie 2 in like a party scene. Crayon Girl is like an extra from the Lego Movie 2. And he was so mad. I mean, he was screaming and he was throwing all the pieces of Crayon Girl on the ground. I had to like put them in my pocket and he, oh my God. And like now his allowance is gone and all he's got is this crappy Crayon Girl figure. It was bad.
Oh.
I just can't help but think of the Buy More Ovaltine scene from A Christmas Story. you know, drink more Ovaltine after he waits forever for the decoder ring for the radio show. Remember that? You don't remember that, do you?
I don't know what movie this is.
No.
What movie is this?
Not everyone. A Christmas Story or whatever it's called.
Who's in
that? Is the one movie that the most amount of people think that everyone has seen, but that not everyone has seen. But people who've seen it think that everyone on the planet knows every line from that movie. I've never watched that movie in its entirety. I don't even, you know.
Yeah. Sorry. Well, I'm sorry for the reference.
It's a Christmas movie.
It didn't make any sense to you guys.
Yeah. If you'd like to find out why I have never seen or even heard of A Christmas Story, stay tuned for the Slate Plus segment.
Yeah,
pretty sure it's you can put two and two together. Yeah. We had a triumph that was based entirely on last week's episode.
Oh.
And I think it's such a great part two. This Sunday, Bass Sunday, as you all know, was Mother's Day. And a lot of hubbub and kerfuffle happened last week as Rebecca, Dan, and I debated general feelings and responses to Mother's Day and tried to make space for the idea that not everyone has an uncomplicated relationship with Mother's Day, that a lot of mothers actually have a complicated relationship with it. And people were some people were struggling to understand that, and some people were like, this is the most obvious thing ever. Someone on the Facebook page compared it to the way, said that in his understanding, it sort of felt similar to the way that a lot of veterans feel about the phrase, thank you for your service, which I thought is an interesting thing that might help broaden people's understanding of why this is not just an unabashedly sort of like positive thing for everyone, that the feelings are complicated. Anyway, so Joe and I have Joe had this insight about hating Mother's Day years ago, and it was in some ways great. It was like the apocalypse finally happened, and then after that, we were living in sort of like a post-apocalyptic freedom of everyone recognizing that Mother's Day was never going to live up to any of the expectations, that no single day was even going to remotely come close to acknowledging the incredible like work and complexity and difficulty of Joe's role as the mother in our family. And I think once I recognized that, she recognized that, it sort of took some of the pressure off of it. And the Mother's Days that we've had since then have been relatively fine, because there hasn't been like her expectations like, okay, these kids better do something fucking awesome. And they didn't. Oh my God, does no one pay attention? Does no one understand what I do? And then, you know, me being like, okay, we got it, guys. We really got to get it right. Otherwise, it's going to be terrible. Like all that was gone. And so the Mother's Days have actually been relatively fine. And there's other complexities that still exist. There's like the whole public performance of it, and there's the people who have the dead mothers like myself, or the people who have the complicated relationship with the mothers, and then there's the adult people trying to please their own mothers who maybe aren't at a place of peace with it. It's complex. Anyway, this year, Mother's Day, I was unfortunately traveling through Sunday. I got back Sunday morning and was going straight to hang out with Joe and the kids right from the airport as I arrived. So Georgia calls me on Friday night, and she's like, when are you coming back? I'm like, not until Sunday morning. She's like, I need help. I'm like, with what? She's like, here's my Mother's Day plan. And she lays out this ridiculously elaborate plan. She's like, I'm going to make this sign, and then I'm going to make this breakfast that I found on the internet, and then I'm going to write this poem, and then I'm going to get these flowers. And then I was like, what is Ezra doing? He's like, Ezra's doing his own thing. I don't know what it is, but he's going to do his own thing. And so she was like, but I need you to help facilitate. I was like, I can't. I'm not in town until, you know, I was like, this sounds like a lot. Are you going to sure you're going to be able to pull this off? You've never cooked a whole meal from beginning to end. And she said on the phone, well, Dad, it's the thought that counts. And I was like, that's true. You're right. It's the thought that counts.
But you don't get to say that about your own activity. Like, you don't get, yourself up to disappoint someone else and then claim that it's the thought that counts.
I understand. But she wasn't saying that because she wasn't going to be putting an effort. She was saying that because she wasn't, none of us were convinced that her effort was going to yield something successful because it was such a huge undertaking. But she's an ambitious kid.
It was her version of get off my back. I'm doing this.
Basically, but it felt like she got it. She was like, look, I'm just going to try. Yeah. I don't know if this is going to work, but you know, we're going to try. Mom's going to appreciate it anyway, because she knows that we're doing it out of love. It could be a disaster. Let's just go, which I thought was great progress for her, because Georgia's a little bit of a perfectionist. And so So she ended up getting, like, Jeff ended up helping, that's Joe's partner, ended up helping with some of the logistics and driving kids around. Ezra put together a thing. He made this, like, really beautiful, like, painting of flower petals that he laminated. I don't even know what his methodology was, but it was this beautiful thing. And then Georgia ended up making this sign. She woke up at 4 in the morning on Mother's Day to decorate the house with streamers and balloons and put up a signs of like construction paper that she cut out that said Happy Mother's Day. She did this poem, she did the flowers, and she made this breakfast, this like stuffed bell peppers, the stuff with eggs and cheese and bacon or something that she had, and she made it from scratch just by herself alone in the kitchen at like 6 in the morning. And everyone, I got there, by the time I got there, they had already eaten, but everyone was like, it was really good. Ezra was like, it's like the best breakfast I've ever had. Like, I don't know how she did it, but it was amazing. The whole thing happened completely successfully. Then the rest of the day, then we had that breakfast. Then I got there. Then we hung out. Jokes were made. We played video games, blah, blah, blah. Then we went to get a brunch together. We went to get brunch. No one got anyone's nerves. We all laughed. Everyone was in a good mood. We went back home. Joe had to go to a thing. She went off to the thing. The kids and I hung out. We watched a movie together. We played some more video games. We ordered dinner. It was just like the perfect day. And it felt like that the perfection of it had everything to do with the fact that there was a universal release from the pressure to have it be perfect. And somehow it all like landed in this comfortable way. And so I was really proud of both kids. I knew Georgia wasn't going to forget because she's like compulsively conscientious. It's one of her things. And I was afraid that Ezra was going to, I didn't think Ezra was going to forget, but I thought maybe he was, I didn't know how he was going to handle it, but he handled it great. I knew he wasn't going to forget because even though his executive functioning struggles in some areas, when it comes to like serious things about seriously like showing appreciation for the people in his life and loving them, he's really good. Like he shows up and gets it and really from his heart tries to make something that means something. And that's all everyone did. Everyone just did something from their heart that meant something. And Joe, I think, felt relieved that she was, she sort of was at peace with the fact that it wasn't going to cover everything, but it was going to feel nice anyway that the kids were there. And it all worked out. It was just such a great thing. And no one got into a fight all day. And I say that because when the four of us are together, our kids often get into some kind of like fracas or hubbub with one another or with us, or they gang up on me or they gang up on Joe, or like it just turns into a whole thing. And none of that happened. Everyone was just on their best behavior and lighthearted, and it just was great. And so that was our triumph as a family.
That's amazing. Good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Happy Mother's Day.
Happy Mother's Day.
Dad.
Dad. Dad and Dad are wishing each other Happy Mother's Day.
Yep. What else is new?
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Before we move on, let's do the business. If you have a question you want us to tackle, you can send us that question in a variety of different ways. One of those ways is you can leave us a voicemail message. You dial 424-255-7833 on your telephone, and you leave the message in our voicemail. Another way is you send us an email message to the email address momanddad@slate.com. I'm going to say that again, momanddad@slate.com. If you're not yet a member of our Facebook group, why the heck not? Go on Facebook, search for Slate Parenting. It's a really fun community. Lots of parents having really good conversations about the show, but also about their own parenting questions, triumphs, fails, etc. Go on Facebook, search for Slate Parenting. All right. On Slate Plus today, I'm going to answer a question that was originally surfaced in that very same Facebook group. Someone was like, Gabe, how come you talk like that if you were born in England? There's an answer. I'll tell you, but only if you're a Slate Plus member. How do I become a Slate Plus member, Gabe? You ask. The answer is you go to slate.com/momanddadplus. And you sign up for Slate Plus. It only costs $35 for your first year. You get a 2-week free trial, and you cancel during that trial. You don't pay anything at all, not even the $35 for your first year. It's so obvious. Why haven't you done this yet? Slate.com/momanddadplus. All right, so I got to tell you about Slate Day. Slate Day takes place on June the 8th at the Highline in New York City. It's an amazing day of Slate entertainment. It includes the first Mom and Dad Are Fighting Playdate, a live show for both parents and kids. I'm going to be there. Carvel's going to be there. It's going to be a performance by Chris Shockwave Sullivan and Andrew Jelly D. Bancroft of Freestyle Love Supreme. Our friends at Pinna will keep your kids laughing and participating with live and interactive trivia, plus an improv comedy game show based on Pinna's kid podcast, Don't Break the Rules. There's going to be free ice cream for kids, free coffee for parents. You should be there. It's going to be a great time. I would love to see you. Again, June 8th in New York. For more information and tickets, go to slate.com/live. But there is so much more at Slate Day. What Next Live, interviewing Wyatt Cenac, Mimi Rocha, and Jumaine Williams. Joel Anderson and Ayman Ismail, the new hosts of Slow Burn and Man Up, will have a live conversation. Nicole Hannah-Jones will talk to the Political Gabfest. And my favorite band, Yo La Tengo, are going to talk to Kurt Anderson for Studio 360 and give a performance. This is a great day of entertainment. Don't miss it. Slate.com/live.
Talking about money can be so hard, especially when the person you're talking to is still learning how to do long division. That's why Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace, is here to help. I'm Bridget, and with my fellow co-host Ryan, we help teach your little ones about complex topics like bankruptcy, climate change, and why there's so much gold at Fort Knox, and so much more. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, let's take a question from a listener. This one came to us on our email address. I've said it before, I'll say it again. It's momanddad@slate.com. It's being read for us by Shasha Leonard.
Hi, Mom and Dad. I have a conundrum. How do I tell my kids that my wife and I are splitting up when we're also both staying put? My wife and I have decided to call it quits after nearly 20 years together. We have 3 kids between ages 3 and 8, and normally we would follow the divorce playbook, sit them down and explain how we'd be splitting up and moving to different houses, explain we both still love them, and so on. But we're one of the many couples that can't afford to set up 2 households. And even if we could, the house we bought last summer is perfect for the kids, even if it's not ideal for the 2 of us. Instead, we're going to live in separate parts of the family home, alternating our time with the kids, communicating mostly by email, and trying to stay out of each other's way. This keeps the kids in the house and the neighborhood while keeping us out of bankruptcy. But they're certainly going to notice that their parents don't talk to each other and are rarely in the same room together. The parenting sites I've read say you want to tell the kids about a split up a few weeks before it happens so they can prepare for it, but not have it weighing on them well before it happens. Ours might not come through until they're out of college. I think they deserve to know what's happening before that, but also I don't want to stress them out when they're not moving and not watching a parent move out, at least anytime soon. So what do we tell them? What's the best way to help kids when their parents are living apart in the same house? Thank you.
Damn.
Yeah.
That is really tough. I mean, I just want to go back because... Mm-hmm. I obviously am in no position to tell this writer inner like what they should or shouldn't do.
That's not what they're asking either. That's the hard part about this question. But go ahead.
It is impossible to imagine. I don't care how perfect this house is for these kids. It is impossible to imagine these kids being well and doing really well and thriving and learning really healthy lessons about relationships and family when this is going to be the way that they're going to be living. And you think until they leave for college. So we're talking at least 10 years for the oldest one. This is going to be the model of the family that they're surrounded with. Listen, there's obviously financial pressure, and I completely relate to the situation. In fact, I was the subject of a story in the Boston Globe the year of my divorce because we couldn't live apart while we were in the process, like the 6 or 8 months or so it took for the divorce to happen. We couldn't live apart. We couldn't afford to set up two households. It really all had to wait until we sold the house and we each had a little bit of money and could get like way scaled down little places to live that the kids went back and forth to. So I've been in this exact situation. The housing market crashed like the same year that my divorce happened, like 2008. And I think I'm going to give you the advice in a second. I promise. I really do believe it's better to live in less than ideal housing with your kids than it is to have this situation with your kids. It is really hard for me to imagine a scenario in which this works out well for anybody. Most of all, the three kids who are going to be living in basically a cold war for as long as it is that you decide it can go on. It's untenable. And the stress that I can imagine that they will be living with, walking on eggshells all the time, because you're going to communicate by email, but they're going to be seeing both of you in the same physical space. How are they going to convey information to each of you? Are they going to come talk to you and then you're going to email their mom and then their mom is going to come talk to the kids and they're never going to feel like they can like just communicate something to both of you at the same time? This is a tough situation that you are about to embark on, and I would be remiss if I didn't point that out. So in terms of telling them, you have a three-year-old. I don't know. I'm just going to be straight. I don't know how to tell a three-year-old this information. Your eight-year-old, I think it can be some version of what you explained here, that you guys are really perhaps prioritizing them and not wanting to disrupt their day-to-day lives. And so you're going to try this unconventional thing and you want them to be communicative and talk to you about how it feels in the moment and so forth. But again, the problem is, what if they do that? You're already setting up this cold war where you're going to be living separate lives in the same house. If the kids do come to you and say, I hate this, like, what's the plan then? Like, are you going to be able to talk to each other then to come up with the next iteration of the situation? I don't know. I don't mean to be unhelpful because it sounds like this is what you have decided. But I cannot in good faith give you like just straight pragmatic advice about how to communicate this when I really just feel in every fiber of who I am that this is just not a great idea, not an ideal situation. And I think that if you tell them anything other than that, I think that if you try to communicate that it's going to be perfect and it's going to be great and it's going to be comfortable, you'll be making more of a mistake because you're going to be setting an expectation that's impossible to fulfill. So whatever it is you decide to do in terms of communicating this, I would set the expectation that it's going to be hard for everybody, because this is, make no doubt about it, going to be very, very hard for everybody. And it's going to be the hardest on the kids. So I guess set the bar low. I'm sorry, that sounds cold, but that's the first thing that jumped to mind for me.
Yeah, I kind of agree with Rebecca, unfortunately. I think that you're asking a lot to live in the same house and communicate by email with three kids running between the two of you. That's a lot. I have seen and witnessed and even been a part of like all kinds of configurations of how families can be together and divorced families can stay. And I get it. Like, there's so many ways to do it. And I also get the reality of like real estate dictating the way your parenting happens. That was literally my situation. You know, when Joe and I separated and I had to move into the studio apartment because I didn't have any, you know, enough money for a 3-bedroom. And then I tried to raise two kids in the studio and that was the whole thing. And then finally got the 3-bedroom. Then I lost the 3-bedroom for using Airbnb, got evicted. And then the price of the 3-bedroom went up by double after I got kicked out and was now in the market for $4,000. And then I couldn't afford another 3-bedroom because it's crazy. So I had to move in with roommates. And, you know, figuring out how that, all that stuff, and then Joe lost her place, but then her partner had a rent-controlled 3-bedroom. This is the reality, and I get it. And so I'm not judging anyone. I just think that practically what you're laying out is really hard to accomplish, and it's really hard on the kids. And so if you can find another way, I would recommend it. That said, If you have to do it, the question of how to tell the kids, I think, I don't know that you actually, this is a weird thing for me to say. This is why I'm halting a little bit, because this doesn't sound like the advice I would normally give, but my gut instinct in this situation is you kind of don't really have to say a whole lot, I don't think. I think you can do a very simple, straightforward explanation of why it is that you're going to be moving to a different part of the house, or one of the parents is going to be moving to a different part of the house. But I don't think you want to go into great detail about we couldn't get along, but we still love you, but our marriage didn't work, because that's the kind of thing that puts a lot of pressure on kids to manage. It is really, you can't underestimate or overestimate. I never know how to say that. You can't overestimate the amount of pressure kids put upon themselves when they become aware of discord in the family unit. From tiny ages, they take on, with their little brains and hearts, such huge senses of responsibility for keeping the family together, because it's their safety net. And so the way that they do that is irrational, and it's not aligned with reality because they're kids, but it's also sort of long term. It develops these permanent habits as those kids grow into teenagers and adults, where they feel an outsized responsibility to care for the people around them and take care of and manage the feelings and behaviors and emotions of everyone. It's a really difficult setup. And so when you're in a situation where you're, as parents are separating, I think you have to be even more careful than you think to keep your kids out of any sense of discord, assuming that they're already going to sense it because kids are sensitive. So given that, you really have to, like, I think, underplay it. And I think you just have to say the minimum that you need to say to answer questions that are going to be asked, questions like, why is it that you're not sleeping in this bedroom? And that question might not even get asked. I mean, I lived in a house where the folks slept in two different bedrooms for a while, and it didn't even occur to me to ask about it. I didn't care. I was thinking about my own Lego shit. This was an afterthought for me. Oh, that is weird that the adults are, I guess. But I didn't, you know, whatever. They were the grownups. And so I feel like I would say as little as possible until someone asks directly, and then I would say as little as I can about that. But I don't think there needs to be a big, hey, we need to sit down as a family and I need everyone to know this is happening, because this is already such a dicey situation for these kids. I wish you good luck with this.
Yeah, the one thing I would add to what you guys have said is, like, these parents, I think, need to be doing, if this is the arrangement that you're going to do, like, if there's really no other housing option and you really like this living in separate parts of the house thing is really the best choice, you need, for the sake of your kids, to work very hard and very quickly on figuring out a relationship between the two of you that can make this situation work. And that relationship is not dad stays at this end of the house, mom stays at that end of the house, and they communicate by email. That's relationship
right. Mm-hmm.
has to be something mm-hmm. along there the lines of, like, we're coworkers and we don't really like each other, but we have to have a good working relationship that keeps this operation moving along smoothly. And we're roommates, and we didn't choose to be roommates. We wound up sharing a house, and we got to be able to be cordial with one another while we talk about the business of, like, living in the same house and parenting the same
yes.
kids. And you have to be able to do that when the kids are there. You have to be able to do that when the kids aren't there. You don't have to love each other. You don't have to be affectionate with each other. You don't even have to be very warm to one another, but you can't be cold and hostile to one another. You have to
yes.
be reasonable with one another. You have to behave like adults with one another. That will make your lives better. That will make your lives not a living hell living in a house with your ex-wife. Right? But it will also save your children from being trapped in an incredibly weird and crazy environment for the rest of their childhoods. And so I urge you to think less about how are we going to, like, what speech do I give to the kids so that after I've made this speech, then, okay, good, I discharged my responsibility there because I made the right speech. I urge you to think less about that and to think more about, okay, me and my wife are going to have to be in rooms, me and my ex-wife, excuse me, are going to have to be able to be in rooms together, sometimes with our children, sometimes not with our children, basically most days for the next 10 years. And we've got to be able to do that without those rooms being miserable. without those rooms feeling the chill of the end of our 20-year marriage. And that's on you guys to figure out how to do that. And I'm sure it's going to be really hard, but that's the job that you have to do if you want to make this thing work. And if you can do that, then as Carvel says, I don't think you have to say all that much to the kids, except that like, oh yeah, I'm sleeping over here now and your mom's still in that room and you should come and get me if you need this or whatever. But, being able to have like all the parents in the same room at the same time and it doesn't feel as though somebody's going to die. That's what your kids really need more than any explanation or speech.
I think that there's this, and again, I am fully aware that I am saying this with only a very small slice of the story that we got from this writer in a right. But there is this idea that kids need like certain environs to be able to like thrive and be healthy. And I was there. I so relate to this email. Like my ex-husband and I had just bought recently before we got divorced, a beautiful 4-bedroom house on a huge lot with a beautiful yard. We put in a swing set. It's in a great school district. Like we were feeling like this is it. This is where our kids are going to grow up. And I had fantasies when we became clear we were going to split up. I had fantasies of us somehow keeping the house. And I even suggested at one point, why don't we keep the house and like get a second place and like we can rotate in and out because the kids really need to stay here in this house. This house is so important to the happiness and comfort and like life of our children. I felt that way. That was wrong. I was wrong to feel that way. A house is a house. A home is a place where when somebody comes home with the groceries, they're either putting it away themselves or they're being helped having them put away by the person that they live with, the partner in their life. A home is not a place where, like, how is that going to work? How are you guys going to grocery shop? If you come home with a car full of food, is your wife going to come out and help you bring it in and load the refrigerator together and like clean out the sink after dinner? And who's going to do the dishwasher? How are those? Like, these are the things. I mean, I agree with Carvel. Like, I don't think your kids are going to give a shit like what your interpersonal like sleeping together thing is. They're probably not going to notice that for a long time. But like, think about the life that you want them to learn to have as adults. And if you're going to do this, figure out a way to model some of that, even though it will be like almost impossible. It really will. So I feel for you. But if your prevailing desire here is to keep the kids in this, you know, house with a certain number of bedrooms and a certain size yard, just know from somebody who has been there that that is not nearly as important as being able to have the kind of life and the kind of relationships that actually help kids thrive and grow up and not be walking on those eggshells all the time and learning those patterns that you might not necessarily wish for them to take into adulthood. So if that helps, it probably doesn't. But again, I'd feel remiss if I didn't say it.
Yeah. Yeah. I would also point out, I mean, we were assuming it's a mom and dad, but I don't think the letter says
We don't know that. And I'm sorry if I made an assumption there.
Right. Okay.
Thanks for writing in and let us know how it goes. We're rooting for you. All right. It's time for the part of the show that I frequently call recommendations. People sometimes ask us, what about that one thing that you recommended a long time ago? Where can I find that? And the answer is the Slate Endorsematic. You go to slate.com/endorsements and you find a searchable database of everything that's ever been recommended by anyone on any Slate podcast ever. So you can search for like Carvel book, and you'll see like a whole long list of young adult novels that Carvel has recommended on this show. Give it a try, slate.com/endorsements. Carvel, mine is just a regular one. Carvel, what's the mood of yours? Let's do a preview of each of them.
I'm just going to continue I'm still glowing from the sort of success of Georgia cooking a meal. She was really into this recipe. I'm going to recommend it. It's a breakfast stuffed peppers with cheese, bacon, and spinach.
Yum.
It is easy. It's low carb. You could cook it for lunch or dinner. And Georgia cooked it all by herself, and it's dominated. It was great. She had the oven. It's very straightforward. There's not a lot of frying and stuff going on. It doesn't require it. So it's like a great meal to make with your kids. Great meal to teach your kids how to make if your kids are just starting to reach that age around 10, 11, 12, 13, when you're starting to want them to know how to do a few things in the kitchen without your help. So we're going to go ahead and post that recipe, breakfast stuffed peppers, in the oven.
Awesome. That'll be on our show page, which you can find by going to our Facebook page and clicking the link. That's how anyone gets to any web pages nowadays. I'm going to recommend something else from my weekend alone with the kids while their mom was out of town. This was the day before we went to Barnes & Noble and bought a disappointing Lego minifigure. The afternoon before, we went to our friend's house and they said, you know, why don't you come on over and the kids can, we'll all eat pizza and the kids can watch a movie. And so we all came over and we all ate pizza. And then the kids went to watch a movie and the movie that their kids wanted to watch, and my kids were like, oh, sure, okay, I'll watch this, was the movie Ponyo from the famous Japanese studio Ghibli. Am I saying that correctly? Famous director, Miyazaki. Everybody knows these movies. Everybody knows these are great movies. The thing I should say is I had seen a couple of the movies, I think, before I had kids. Like, I went to see either Spirited Away or Howl's Moving Castle by the same director when it came out in the theater because it was getting such great reviews. And I found it quite boring and slow and wasn't able to get into it. And then I always had the idea that, like, oh, yeah, that stuff is not for me. The Miyazaki stuff is not for me. And so I never really watched it with my kids. I tried to get my kids interested in one of them once, but they weren't really into it. But so we wound up putting on Ponyo, and I sat down on the couch. I was pretty tired because I'd gotten up early with the kids and I'd been at it with them all day. And I wound up, you know, my friends, the grown-up members of our friend family also sat down on the couch, and we all wound up watching Ponyo together. Ponyo is a fucking awesome movie. Holy cow. It is really genuinely sort of magical and feels immersive and like a real fairy tale. And it doesn't feel Disney-fied. It feels, it's not sentimental, but it's unbelievably full of emotion and sweetness and affection and love between this little boy, 5-year-old boy, and the fish girl who comes out to play with him, and they wind up saving the day because they're so brave, but they also feel like genuine children. They don't feel like little tiny adults in a like child cartoon body. Wow. So I'm late to the party on this recommendation, but if you haven't seen it or if you think this is not the kind of thing that you and your family would be into, really give Ponyo a chance. And my kids also loved it. So that is my recommendation.
That's the second time someone has recommended that to me this week. My son Teddy is a huge fan of those films, and he was like, we have to watch this. But now that you've said it, I'll probably do it because I was resisting.
it's surprising and emotional. Wow.
Sorry, Teddy.
No, I was too, but it's worth pushing through because it's very real. It's very real. All right, what's your downer recommendation?
Well, it's not so much a recommendation. It is a request. I would recommend that our listeners... So my husband, Kevin, as you all know, had cancer surgery a couple months ago. He's having another one. His cancer journey is not over, and that is happening this week. And I would just ask that everybody, you know, I'm not a religious person, so I'm not going to say pray. But, you know, just get your screened for your thyroid stuff when you can. And also think about my husband and wish him well through his next surgery. This one's going to be bigger than the previous one, and it's sort of like on the top of my mind. And I do think, I will confess, perhaps influenced some of my pragmatism around the answer to the question that the listener posed this week. I am not about right now wasting a ton of time living the way that you don't want to live. It's not good for anyone, because sometimes there are moments in your life where, you know, you really just realize that that's just not important. The trappings are not important. What's important is the people that you love. So focus on that. And please, I recommend that you send nice thoughts to my wonderful husband, Kevin. I hope that wasn't too much of a downer.
good luck to Kevin and good luck to you, Rebecca. We will be thinking.
Thanks. Thank you.
All right, that's our show. Slate Plus members, stick around. If you, like many members of our Facebook group, were curious to understand why I talk the way I do if I grew up in England, Rebecca wanted to know. I'm going to explain that for you. If you have a question that you want us to tackle, perhaps you're getting divorced and are proposing an unusual arrangement, living situation, and you'd like us to weigh in, you can give us a call, 424-255-7833, or send us an email. That email address is momanddad@slate.com. We have a Facebook group. It's great. I always talk about it. Facebook. Search for Slate Parenting, and then you can talk about the show or ask parenting questions or share triumphs or fails or whatever you like. Good stuff. Go to Facebook. Search for Slate Parenting. Mom and Dad Are Fighting is produced by Jess Jupiter. For Rebecca Lavoie and Carvel Wallace, I'm Gabriel Roth, and we will see you next time.